I'm going to go back to Noah's question, and there's follow-up. And I will read all of these, but I'm not sure I can read them all today. So here's Noah's question once again. Forgive my metaphysical realism, but did I hear you correctly that the information on your computer is something above and beyond a complex configuration of electricity and chemicals? If so, then what exactly is information and how could it be causally efficacious? So it is a very rich question, and I think, in fact, it is very relevant for practice. So it's not just, you know, heading off into metaphysical speculation. Where I'd like to begin is right with the something that for which I just got some greater clarity just very recently as I was reading a commentary to the Dhammapada, these core aphorisms of the Buddha. And in fact, it was a commentary to the very first verse when the Buddha states all phenomena, the mind precedes all phenomena, all phenomena are based upon the mind and consist of the mind. It was a commentary on that. And it shed greater light on something that I've known about for a long time, but I think I really never had much clarity on it. And in Sanskrit and in Pali, it's called nama-rupa, or in Tibetan, mingzu. And this is a very, very large topic. I don't think I've ever actually heard a very detailed explanation of it myself, but the commentary I read was very helpful, and here's the gist of what it said. That the Buddhist view of the human being, or of any other sentient being for that matter, is not that we are composed of two semi-autonomous parts. There's the mind here, and then there's the body over there, and then somehow the mind separates from the body, and it goes off and finds another body, and it latches onto that body, and then this body just molders away, and so forth. It's not so clunky, it's not so Cartesian. And it's indicated by this very term, mingzuk, or name and form, nama rupa, name and form. So Sanskrit's very rich, Pali is quite rich. If they really wanted to say body and mind, they would simply would have said mind and body or mind and form. But it didn't. It said name and form, name and form. And the way this was glossed, I don't know how representative this is of the entire Theravada tradition, but I found it meaningful and very sensible, is that this is not indicating some kind of an autonomous or quasi-autonomous mind and an autonomous body that can join and separate, but rather a flow of experience. A flow of experience, he actually used the word pure experience, but let's just keep with experience, that has multiple facets to it. And one of the facets of experience, without introducing some agent, like a person, an ego, a self, a flow of experience, and a facet of experience, and I think we can resonate with this in our own experience, is there's a facet of experience that entails naming, labeling, and conceptually imputing. Right? And what are we conceptually imputing? Well, what's arising is form. Now, form in the broadest sense of the term, not just as in shapes and colors, but form referring to all manner of appearances, to the five physical senses, to mental awareness, all of these are forms in a broad sense of the term. As we speak of form realm, well, it's not just shapes and colors, it's form as in appearances. And so here's what's being suggested here, is an ongoing flow of experience. Experience is inextricable from the appearances that are arising, which means it's inextricable from the consciousness of the appearances that are arising. And one facet or one activity of the consciousness of the forms or appearances that are arising is this ongoing flow of naming, of labeling, of conceptually designating. But it's all of a piece. It's all of a continuum. And then out of this naming and labeling process, then we, in a manner of speaking, we coagulate, we objectify, and then very often reify, but we objectify is a really good word because we make objects. Appearance is an ongoing flow, and then we make objects. So I have an appearance, and then I make an object from my perspective. Ah, there's the nun Sepel. Ah, there's the Englishwoman Elizabeth. And so there's appearances, but I've done much more than the appearances. I'm not just getting appearances, which is maroon and gray and flesh-colored and so forth. I'm now seeing that and having engaged with Sepel, I have some idea of what these appearances signify. And so then I objectify, and there is a labeling process, and usually in the labeling there is also a reification, exactly as in a non-lucid dream, that there's a flow of appearances, there's an experience of appearances, and within the dream there's the labeling, the conceptual imputation or designation, and lo and behold, then we make objects that coagulate, that form, that objectify within the flow, and then part of that, of course, is, there's the object over there, But sequentially, actually, there is a first of an objectification or a reification, a coagulation around self. And then out of that, referring back to Dharmakirti, then there's this objectification of the other, which has attributes, and the attributes pertain to these various appearances that arise. But the core here, what is fundamental or primary, is this ongoing flow of experience, including appearances. Ah, that's very nice. She's taking care of our shoes because it just started raining. The flow of experience, which includes appearances, which includes the naming process. And then what occurs out of that flow, which is all of a piece, all entangled, is then out of that we then designate, we name mind. What's experiencing all of this? Oh, I'm experiencing all of this with my mind. So I isolate myself as more like a stone within the river, because I am always here. The appearances are coming and coming, but I am always here. And I've got a mind with which I'm perceiving and understanding, knowing these appearances. So now I've got a mind, but of course the mind is not the same as the objects that I'm attending to, that I'm labeling and designating. And of course, among objects, oh, this one, body. My mind has a body. My mind perceives a body. Gosh, I wonder how the body and the mind interact. Because the body is so tangible. It's made out of molecules. It's made out of cells. Whereas my mind is intangible. It's not made out of cells. It's not made out of molecules. It's intangible, immaterial. Gosh, how could they ever interact? What a mystery. We make the mystery by separating the flow of experience into these two camps, reify both of them, reifying one as immaterial, intangible, and so forth, and the other one we reify as physical. But the physical wasn't the physical, the category of physical wasn't in the appearances themselves. It's something that is frozen, derived from, based upon, imputed upon the appearances, but then becomes solidified as the human construct, the physical. That made a lot of sense to me. That this whole mind-body problem is one created by humans, for humans, and it hasn't been solved yet. Right? This is not a form of idealism. Oh, you mean only the mind is real? No, the very notion of mind is every bit as constructed as the notion of body. Named upon forms. Name and form. I found that very interesting and very helpful. And then at the same time as I was reading it, it struck me as very familiar. Because one of my intellectual heroes, you know his name well by now, William James, he had a very similar idea, and he was almost entirely ignorant of Buddhism. So I don't think there's any indication, at least in this lifetime, that is his lifetime that ended a century ago, that he just borrowed this from Buddhism. I don't see any evidence for that at all. But he had two themes that I think are very relevant to Buddhism altogether, both in practice and in theory. First of all, in terms of practice, he emphasized what he called radical empiricism. That we should take as primary the immediate contents of our experience, whether it's sensory, whether it's mental, and we should take that very seriously, whether or not it conforms or is justified or is allowed by our beliefs, our metaphysical systems, and so forth. So specifically here, he was critiquing, really challenging, what he called materialistic monism, which we simply call physicalism or scientific materialism, that everything, of course, after all, boils down to matter and the emergent properties of matter. And he said, you know, that's just a belief system where it is the very concept of matter and the very concepts of mind. So now he's moving beyond just body and mind. He's moving into these larger categories of mind and matter. Both of these are constructs that are stemming from what he called pure experience. Out of pure experience, then we human beings, we designate and we construct the category of the physical, the material. We define it and then we reify it. And likewise, based upon our subjective experience, then we name and we categorize and then we reify mind. But he said neither mind nor matter is primary. And thinking that either one is primary sets up all kinds of utterly insoluble conundrums. Problems that still have no solution in sight. So modern cognitive science is very largely based upon an antiquated Cartesian notion of body and mind being absolutely separate and coming together and connected by way of the pineal gland, extremely fanciful. But then what happened since the time of Descartes, and he articulated this perhaps with greater intelligence and clarity than others, so therefore we call it the Cartesian dualism. But what's happened over the last 400 years since he formulated this reified dualism is that science across the boards, from physics, chemistry, biology, and onto the mind sciences, neurophysiology and so forth, has made tremendous strides observing the physical, understanding the physical, the objective, and the quantifiable. So we're all the recipients of this fantastic growth of scientific knowledge of the physical, the objective, and the quantifiable, which has grown up correspondingly with this tremendous growth of sophistication of technology, including instruments of observation. So it's a tremendous success story of observing the physical, the objective, and the quantifiable. Frankly, it was the philosopher's job. It was the philosopher's job there in the early 17th century, the late 16th century, for them, not the natural philosophers, but the philosophers whose subject was really the mind, it was their job to devise a corresponding technology, that is, sophisticated modes of observation, to investigate the other side of the Cartesian dichotomy, and that is, okay, well, if you want to have the mind be something separate, for heaven's sakes, investigate it. Observe it, practice introspection, take Descartes' relatively primitive ideas of introspection and refine them, develop them. And so the philosophers and then the people who came to be called scientists would develop and progress in tandem, hand in hand, with increasing technology for exploring subjective experience together with the increasing technology for exploring the objective world, and they would augment and accentuate each other over the last 400 years until we would have a sublime science of subjective experience of the nature of the mind, including multiple dimensions and consciousness and so forth. We've had 400 years to do it. It didn't happen at all, frankly, at all. I mean, not even samadhi, not even a three-power telescope samadhi. Nothing at all. Even in 2003, when I spoke with Jonathan Cohen from Princeton, and I asked him, you know, basic questions, can attention be developed? He said, we don't know at this point. That's 7 years ago. And he's a world expert as a cognitive neurophysiologist. And so what happened here is, from my perspective, is that tremendous success story with the technology and the science, observing the objective, the physical, the quantifiable, but in terms of the subjective, the qualitative, quantitative and physical, and the non-physical. Because obviously thoughts don't have any mass, emotions. I mean, it's just obvious that all of these qualia, the immediate impressions, the immediate contents of experience, the colors we see, the sounds we hear, the tastes, the feelings, the emotions, all of these, none of these have any physical properties at all. It's just obvious. They're not made out of molecules or atoms. They're not made out of electricity or force fields. They're not in any way do they demonstrate or reveal any physical qualities. So we could conceivably have had a subjective science, a contemplative science that would have matched by decade, century by century, matched this extraordinary progress of the objective sciences with a subjective, qualitative, non-physical science of the mind, and it didn't happen. And so one non-success story in that regard and one tremendous success story. And so what happens when history plays itself that way? Where you have, frankly, a winner and loser, because scientists won and the theologians and the philosophers simply have no even remotely comparable body of consensual knowledge. Not even close. And I don't think there would be a philosopher that would deny that. Because they get together and, frankly, they just argue. They don't agree on anything. Virtually nothing at all. Not even on the existence of qualia. Daniel Dennett says qualia don't exist. John Searle says qualia do exist. That's called no agreement at all, right? And some have actually gone on to say consciousness doesn't exist. And so what's happened here, I think, through this weird and imbalanced evolution of knowledge over 400 years is to the winner go the spoils. The spoils were the mind. And they said, well, look, we won. We're just going to take the mind and we're going to call it what we know about. And what we know about is the physical, the objective, and the quantifiable. Therefore, mind, welcome to our corral. We're going to put you in our basket, And hey, everybody, the mind is physical, it's quantifiable, and it's objective, and that's because it really consists of the brain or emergent properties or functions of the brain. And so I think this happened just because of the way it's this imbalance of evolution of history over the last 400 years in particular. Where does information come in here? It's said all the time now. It's absolutely common terminology that the brain stores immense amounts of information, that neurons, dendrites, synapses, and so forth are processing information, conveying information, large configurations of neurons process information throughout the brain, the visual cortex processes visual information, and so forth. And the word information is used all the time, pretty much exactly in the same way that it's used for computers, because the brain is considered to be an organic computer, a very, very, the most complex one we know in all of nature. But I'd come back then to your question, Noah, about information, and I'm speaking from a Buddhist perspective. So right or wrong, I think this is a correct portrayal of Buddhist view. If it winds up being totally wrong, well, okay. But I think I'm doing my best to portray what would be a Buddhist take on this. And so in the Prasangika Madhyamaka view, this is the middle way view and widely regarded as the most sophisticated interpretation of that. When there's a common way of speaking, such as my computer holds so many RAM, or my hard drive, or my gigabytes, or what have you, and the RAM, it can process this amount, and the hard drive this amount, and so forth, and that's how much information my computer can process. This has become utterly commonplace terminology now. So for a Buddhist to come in and say, I'm sorry, but you can't talk that way anymore, doesn't work that way. We have to see how the word is being used, and then see if delusion is setting in, not just by using the word, but by reifying it. And I would suggest this is exactly what's happened. So I will say, in my laptop, there's a great deal of information. As I mentioned, I've downloaded dozens, if not scores and scores of Tibetan books. So there's an awful lot of information in there. How did that happen? Well, I went on to the TBRC website for Tibetan texts, thousands of Tibetan texts, and I've downloaded these off the internet. And so then wherever I go, I carry a massive library with me. But that took an awful lot of work by the folks there in New York City at TBRC, digitalizing this thousands and thousands of texts so I can simply, in a matter of seconds or a few minutes, download texts. So how did the information get in there? If I just focus on this amount of information in my computer, which is there, I do agree. Well, it took these wonderful people in New York City an enormous amount of time reading the text, scanning the text, and they, as conscious beings, human beings, knowing what they're doing, for whom this is information, they're reading the Tibetan text on paper, digitalizing them, scanning them, putting them up on the internet so I can download them. They, as conscious, intelligent, information processing human beings, they have enabled me to download that information into these silicon chips, the electrons, electricity in my computer. And I, being another conscious and at least sufficiently intelligent human being, that I can read the texts, then within that sandwich of those who formulated or configured the information, boxed it, so to speak, so that it could be downloaded, independence upon them enabling me to put the information in and me being able to get the information out, in that cognitive framework, there is indeed information in my computer. And I can transfer that information over to yours. In fact, I've sent Mugi a couple of texts, I think three or four texts. And so with just a few keystrokes, I've sent him four texts. And so now he has more information on his computer than he had before, right? That information has no mass. The information is not composed of molecules or atoms, nor is it composed of silicon chips or electrons. It's not composed of that. Information itself is not physical. And I'm using the word, I know the word is used in two different ways. And so I'll get out my knife right now. In straight physics, sometimes the word information is used in a completely objective, physical, quantifiable way, and it's simply inversely related to entropy. Just that. So information implies the opposite of entropy, which doesn't have any semantic value. So that information doesn't inform, it doesn't convey information. It's just a purely physical construct, and physicists can define it as they like, and they have. But John Wheeler, one of the most brilliant theoretical physicists we've had in the latter part of the 20th century, now passed away. He took this notion of information, and he kind of said, okay, whatever that, that emaciated form of information that has it's just reverse entropy, basically. He said, well, let's come back to information as we human beings. And now when we speak of information in my computer, information in the brain, and so forth, let's come back to that. And he refers to this as semantic information. That is, it has meaning. This is information that informs. A reverse of entropy doesn't inform anybody about anything, right? It's just a purely quantitative deal. And so coming to this theme of semantic information, and that's exactly what I'm focusing on here, objectively speaking, or to use Buddhist terminology, from its own side, there's a computer there in my room right now, from its own side, independent of any cognizers, anybody who's informed, any human being, any sentient being, any conscious being, independently of any conscious being who can make sense of or understand the information put into and that can be retrieved from the computer, independent of that, of all that community of conscious information processors, right? There is no information in that computer at all. All that's in it is what you would see through a microscope. Or just open it up and you'll see something, and then take off the lid, you'll see more, and then start taking apart and you'll see more, and get a microscope out, and you'll see more and more and more, right down to, let's say, get an electron microscope out, and you'll see it right down to the subatomic level. But what you'll see from the time you look at the laptop sitting on your lap, let's say, until you bring up your electron microscope, all the way down to the fundamental ingredients, in other words, in a zoom lens from seeing the whole laptop all the way down to elementary particles, what you will never see at any time as you look at it objectively is information of any sort. Because it's not there objectively. It's not there independently. It's not there in the computer boxed in that titanium package. Now, if we relate this, but it does exist. It exists conventionally relative to those who are informed. Take away the one who is informed, and now this is basic logic, and I think it's really good logic. And that is information, if we're using the word semantically, information requires a tripod. For information to exist, it's one of three legs of a tripod. For information to exist, there has to be something about which one is informed. If I tell you, no, I got some new information for you, blah, 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 blah. That didn't refer to anything. So I don't think you got any information except for maybe a reaffirmation. Alan is definitely on the weird side. But that's not what I was trying to convey. That just came along as a free gift. And so, no, there was no information there. I did not enhance your knowledge of anything. Because that was inarticulate sound. There was noise, and there was a person ready to be informed, and a person who has the capacity to inform, but blah, 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 that was not information. Why? Because it didn't convey anything. There was nothing about which you were informed. If I tell you that this is my wristwatch, there's another phrase. It's still sound waves coming out my mouth, but this is my wristwatch. In case you wondered whether I borrowed it, no, this my wife gave me for my birthday about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. So now you didn't probably know that. But now you know it. So there's something about which there was something that was the content of the content, the referent of the information. This is indeed my wristwatch. There was the verbal act. This is my wristwatch, Noah. And then there was the person who's informing you. I'm telling you, I know what I'm talking about. This is indeed my wristwatch. Take away any one of those three. If there's no informer, information doesn't take place. If there's no one who's informed, information doesn't take place. If there's no referent in the act of being informed, information doesn't take place. Okay? So it's a tripod. It's the knower, the act of knowing, and the known. And now we're just using the word information. But if I shout out into deep space, hello, this is my wristwatch, and nobody hears me, then no one got informed. Right? So that wasn't really a conveying of information to anybody because I already knew it. Right? So the three... You can't be an informer if you convey no information or if there's no one who's informed. There's no information if you take off either of the other two. And if no one's informed, then again, the act of informing never took place because nobody got informed. So the three are mutually interdependent. Okay? So this raises interesting questions about the brain then. Because exactly in the same way, they're using the same terminology, and by no mistake, because many neurophysiologists just look upon the brain as a computer. An organic computer, what I have found, well, of course, they're using the same terminology, But the, in my sense of it, now maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't seen any indication I'm wrong, so I'm waiting for this. My sense is that they are absolutely reifying the physical presence of information inside the brain, that they are discovering it, they're observing it, it's really there. There's not only chemicals and electricity, there's also information, and I get the impression they're taking this very seriously, as in there's information really in there, and this neuron or this ganglia of neurons is informing, sending a message. They use this all the time. This ganglia of neurons is sending the message over to this, and they're sending the message, it's like a whole bunch of little creatures in there. And according to this Columbia neuroscientist, there are about 900 billion of them, all of them who know where they are, and they're all saying, hey, Stacy, hey, Noah, oh, yeah. They've got this gossip going among 900 billion, all communicating, babbling away. No wonder we have so much obsessive, compulsive flow of thoughts, because we got 900 billion neurons chatting with each other. Yeah. To my mind, this is a sheer rampant case of animism. But instead of looking upon the whole of nature and reading sentient beings into plants and rocks and rivers and trees and mountains and lakes and everything else and imbuing them with a sentient quality, and that's called animism, anthropomorphizing the constituents of physical nature and making them actual all sentient beings who are conspiring to, you know, bless us or curse us and so forth, all that kind of business, I think it's exactly this. I think it's actually a very primitive mentality of animism that falsely imposes a sentient being where there isn't any sentient being. I see the same thing taking place here in the neuroscience. I think it's animism, where they're turning these neurons or complexes of neurons and turning them into sentient beings and taking too seriously, reifying the notion they are actually sending messages. They're getting information. They're processing information. Human beings process information. Intelligent minds process information. My computer just goes chugga, 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 chugga. It doesn't process anything on its own, except relative to my mind that's making sense of what it's doing. But a computer by itself doesn't process anything. It's just a bunch of chemicals and electricity going chugga, 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 chugga. They don't remember anything. They don't process anything. They don't know anything. They don't understand anything. And they don't compute anything. Silicon chips with electrons don't compute anything at all. They just bump into each other. So does a computer compute? Yeah, because there are human people who create the programs and make sense of what the computer does. If the brain is a computer, who programmed it? And I think we're still working out of a theistic model that's, oddly enough, made its way into modern science, that somebody programmed it. There was somebody out there, it used to be God, and now I guess it's just nature, but somehow information got in there, and then they reify it, as if God really is now a blind watchmaker. I think that was a term used by one reductionist. But the notion now that the, never mind consciousness, what they've done is they've just put the cart before the horse. Instead of regarding information and this flow of experience as being primary from which we formulate, we categorize, we isolate the object of brain, and we formalize, categorize, and isolate the concept mind, instead of recognizing that experience, the flow of experience is primary, they've made the brain primary. And they've assumed that information is intrinsically in there. And now, lo and behold, they have a mind-body problem. Because if the brain is that which gives rise to the emergent properties now, they're derivative, they're secondary, they're maybe even epiphenomenal, that is our subjective experience of emotions, thoughts, and so forth. If the brain is just the great engine, basically a little God, spewing out, you know, letting float out these emergent properties of thoughts, images, and so forth, and these are emergent properties like all other emergent properties in nature, the first answer is they absolutely are not like any other emergent property in the whole of nature. There are many, many emergent properties throughout nature. It's a very good category. It occurs in Buddhism as well. But all emergent properties of physical phenomena are themselves physical and therefore lend themselves to physical measurement. But the lemon that I was visualizing a couple of weeks ago, if that's an emergent property of my brain, how come no neuroscientist can measure it? And how come it displays no physical attributes whatsoever? No mass, no location, no spin, no charge, nothing. So it's just a complete categorical error to think that somehow subjective experience is an emergent property of the brain when the very category of the brain is something that that consciousness, the flow of experience, has isolated, formulated, and reified. So one area this gets very interesting is, well, there are many areas it's interesting. One is this whole, it's called the hard problem. Now that we've reified the brain into, and its underlying, the underlying mechanisms in the brain that somehow give rise to the fluff, the emergent properties of subjective experience, now that we've set the scene that way, we're telling this is our story, that the brain is primary, and it somehow generates thoughts and influences thoughts, emotions by chemicals, electricity, and so forth and so on, and by environmental influences. We have the hard problem, and that is, how is it that these chemicals and electricity, I mean, there's nothing else to call them, that's all there is in there, chemicals and electricity, and the causal interactions among them, that's it. How is it that they can actually give rise to subjective experience? That's the hard problem. It's been around for decades, and I would have to say, I think there's been zero progress. It's inexplicable, is intractable, unknown now as it was when the problem first came up. And I think the reason for that is because the whole fundamental premise is false. That's why there's no progress. I'll give you another area where there's no progress whatsoever, and it's even more interesting than that, or at least it's as interesting. In 1955, the term placebo effect was coined. It was found that you give a person something like a sugar tablet or a salt tablet, tell them this will get rid of your migraine or something else, and lo and behold, even though you know, you as a physician or the researcher, you know that this has no effect whatever because it's designed not to, you tell the person, and if they have faith, confidence, belief, and expectation and desire that this will in fact get rid of the migraine, you give them something that has no causal efficacy whatsoever that should in any way influence the presence or absence of migraine, and lo and behold, the migraine goes away. So this was discovered. Now, what strikes me, first of all, when I read that, was why did it take them so long? That's 1955. The scientific study of the mind began in about 1875. It took them 80 years to figure this out? Because there was no word for it before then. And it was only in 1967 that Congress passed an act that stated to the drug companies that you have to demonstrate not only that your drug is safe, that's all you required before then. It's safe. So you can give them little dirt tablets and that would be okay. You know, it had to be safe but effective as well, from 1967, so that's a long time. It has to live up to what you say on the box. If you say this is going to relieve headache, show us some evidence. That was in 1967. That's when that law was written. It took them a while. But now we have this oddity. Now, number one, the fact that it's called the placebo effect should be thrown up as an enormous red flag. Because what it is, in the words of one expert here, a man named David Moorman, he's looked into this very closely, written books and essays on it, articles, scientific papers. As I recall, I think he's a medical doctor, but I'm not absolutely sure of that. But he said, and I'm agreeing with him because he said it long before I did, this is, calling it the placebo effect is the worst possible name because it's simply not that. He calls it a meaning effect, because it has to do with semantic meaning. I, as the physician, let's say, come to you and say, here, take this, I'm conveying information to you that has meaning. It's semantic. I'm not just reversing entropy in your brain. I'm giving you semantic information. I'm telling you, Noah, if you take this, your headaches will go away. Trust me, I'm a Harvard physician, researcher. I really know what I'm talking about. This is the latest drug. This is better than anything else. Just take this and watch the effects. And if you believe me, you got confidence in me, and you see the tablet, and you take it, you expect it to work, chances are very good it will. Now, that in 1955 was unexpected, weird, I think in some respects unwelcome, because there was a large portion of the scientific community that said, oh, that's only for psychosomatic diseases. It has no physical impact. If you simply believe something, that will have no physical impact on your body. That's just for stuff that wasn't real in the first place, psychosomatic symptoms, and now I've introduced something mental, and so, yeah, psychosomatic was dispelled by just believing something. They really warded this off. They were really resistant. What I just said is absolutely false. Now, there are very good brain studies, definitive brain studies, showing that believing that something will work has measurable effects on the brain. Sometimes, for depression, this has been well studied. If I give you something, a pill, and say, this will help you with your depression, and lo and behold, it does, they have measured the effects of the so-called placebo effect on the brain, and sometimes it has the same effect as the drug. Sometimes it has another effect, not like the drug, but it still makes the depression go away, right? Well, you can imagine if you're a hardcore materialist, reductionist materialist, This is the last thing you wanted to hear. That something as intangible, as ephemeral, as apparently non-physical, as belief and expectation and faith should have physical impact on your brain and not just like sticking a finger into it. Here's the one interesting, one I find most interesting, and it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine before 1985, so I've not been able to track down the exact source, but it was told by a very reputable neurologist in Australia, Charlie Teo. And so he's a very good neurologist. And so he wasn't able to tell me the exact source, but he's not a flake. He's a very fine scientist. The study was this, that a study was done of giving people aspirin, giving them another chemical that was specifically designed to thin the blood, and another was a placebo. And they found, now I don't remember the exact statistics, but the chemical and the aspirin were quite comparable in terms of the measured efficacy for thinning the blood. And that makes sense. We know aspirin does, and the chemical was designed to do that, so they were very comparable. And just a little bit less effective was the placebo. Now, I asked somebody here, maybe to keep it private, no big deal, but I asked someone who has actually taken medication for medical reasons, obviously, to thin the blood, and I said, what did it feel like when you took the medication? I think it was an injection. What did it feel like when your blood was thinner? He said, you can't tell anything at all. It's not like a headache going away. You just can't feel anything at all. So how is it that you could give a person a sugar tablet and tell them, this will thin your blood. This would be very good to avoid stroke and so forth. But this will thin your blood. And they believe you. And with that belief, that triggers the specific mechanisms in the brain and the rest of the body to do whatever is necessary to thin your blood. How is that possible? If it's just depression, not that big of a, not so mysterious, but thinning the blood? I don't know how to thin blood. The sugar tablet doesn't know how to thin blood. You don't know how to thin blood. And yet that was it. It thins it almost as well as the aspirin and the chemical designed to thin the blood. How is that possible? Well, my answer is it's absolutely impossible if the materialists are right. It makes no sense, and they've known about this effect now for 55 years. They're no closer now to explaining why the placebo effect works now than they were 55 years ago. That should be a red flag. That's because you've got something fundamentally wrong, and this is an inexplicable problem because of the underlying assumptions. But now consider, now I want to relate this back to Namarupa. If you, Noah, I'm just making this a little bit personal, but if you, Noah, are not just, if you consist not of one big chunky mass, body of absolutely inherently existent molecules, atoms, cells, and so forth, and then somehow in this mysterious relationship, you have a non-physical mind composed of emotions, thoughts, consciousness, and so forth, none of which have any physical attributes whatsoever. If you don't exist in that way, because if you do, then we've got a big problem. Placebo's inexplicable, how this big chunk of matter generates or even influences subjective experience, inexplicable, no progress. But consider that Noah is in fact an ongoing flow of experience. And out of that ongoing flow of experience, you in the naming tendency within that flow of experience, you have named yourself as an individual, you've observed your body and you've named your body, you've named my body and the bodies of other people around you, you've been aware that you have emotions, thoughts, personal history, memory, and you've named that categorically as this is my mind is confused, my mind is clear. You've named this, but imagine that you are fundamentally a flow of consciousness, which includes a flow of appearances, which includes a flow of knowing. The flow of experience with appearances and knowing, I think we can rephrase that, as you are a flow of cognizant information. It's a flow of being informed about the appearances, a flow of the act of being informed, a flow of there being cognizance, the sense of there being a subject, a cognizance of that. You are a flow of the informed, the process of being informed and the one who is informed. You're a flow of that. You are essentially a flow of information. Now let's imagine that there's some problem in your brain. Well, let's say the brain, the blood in your thick, the blood in your brain is too thick. Okay, let's go back to that one. So there are two ways that I can address that. As if I were a physician, I could either come in and I can give you a drug that is chemically known to have this effect that it will thin your blood. And so I come in and I administer that, and lo and behold, your blood thins. Or I can give you a pill and tell you, no, this will, and lo and behold, your blood thins. I would suggest the following analogy. Noah, I have a request for you. It's an actual request. I see your left hand there on your right forearm or upper arm. Would you please just raise your left hand vertically? Yeah. And now put it back down again. Thank you. He did it. Anybody who's listening on the podcast, he did it. I asked in a nice way. And he didn't think, I think he trusted me enough that I'm not going to, you know, do something bad. So he lifted his arm up and he put it back down again. Now there's another way I could do that. Get the same job done. I could run, you're stronger than I am, so I'm not sure this would work out all that well. But I could jump on you and just yank your arm up and then yank your arm down again. I might be able to do it if I caught you by surprise. You're stronger than I am, so I'm not so sure about this. But that's another way of doing it. Just get in there and manhandle you up. Manhandle you down. Same movement of the arm, but one I got in there and just muscled you, and the other one I said, would you please do it? I conveyed information, you processed it, you understood it, saw no reason to object. You raised your arm, you went down. When we administer drugs or surgery to the brain, we're getting in there and we're manhandling. We're wrestling them. We just hit them with something, a scalpel or a drug, and we make something happen. The serotonin level goes down, it goes up, dopamine goes down or up. This is activated, this is deactivated. But we get in there with just sheer brute force. But if, in fact, you are not simply a big chunky body with an ephemeral mind, but if fundamentally the chunky body and the ephemeral mind are two derivative constructs created and labeled, named out of the flow of appearances and naming, if you are fundamentally an information flow of information, then by my telling you as one flow of information to another flow of information, this pill will really thin your blood. The information goes at the information level being primary, triggers whatever biological mechanisms are necessary to bring about the expected and desired result. It's information to information. Basically, when a doctor gives a placebo and says, this will definitely help you, it's like asking you, would you please raise your arm and put it back down again? The information was conceived, it was processed, and it was acted upon. In whatever complex configuration of biological or phenomena or processes was needed, which who knows? I certainly don't know. But if you're fundamentally information, it just goes in the information door rather than the brute force door. So, why doesn't any of this that I've just said make any sense? And the reason it doesn't make any sense is because we know that when Noah was conceived, we know scientifically that when he was conceived, there was a really lucky sperm cell out of the millions that were striving. There was a really lucky sperm cell that managed to get together with the egg, inseminated it, and then now we have motion pictures just showing the whole process. It's really quite amazing technology to show how that little fertilized egg then just gradually develops. And you can watch it all, documentaries just showing the whole formation through the, you know, in the embryo, developing until you find a little child and a little baby comes out and say, you see, it was just molecules. It was just cells, and cells are made of molecules of atoms, atoms of elementary particles. That's what started Noah. It was matter, you see. We watched it. Watch the video again. Do you see anything spooky there? It's just matter. And therefore, over the course of time, that little inseminated egg became conscious, and then it became intelligent conscious, then it became baby conscious, and then it became a baby conscious, young man conscious, and still quite young man consciousness. But you see, we watched it. That completely ignores the fact that when you ask physical questions, you're going to get physical answers. And you'll not get anything other than physical answers. If you're observing with physical instruments, you will observe physical phenomena. You'll not get anything that's not physical because they're not designed to detect anything that's non-physical. If we brought a Tibetan yogi in here, a highly accomplished one, or let's say a Burmese or a Sri Lankan, I don't mean to, put it all on the Tibetans. But according to Buddhism, One of the types of clairvoyance is Jin Sim Xie Bing Wen Xie. A heightened awareness, a paranormal, what we call it, extrasensory motor perception, that is, operating by way of the five physical senses. There is, and it can be developed through samadhi, an ability, a heightened ability, a paranormal ability, in the sense of being not normal, and it's called the extrasensory ability to be able to know the mind of another. Geshe Rabten taught me this a long time ago. He said, with a certain degree of cultivation of samadhi, and it might be sufficient, I don't know whether you need vipassana, I can't remember. But samadhi probably, I think it's sufficient. According to Buddhaghosa, I think it's sufficient. You develop sufficient samadhi, and you can actually detect the presence of another person's consciousness. Not intuit it, not infer it on the basis of behavior, but actually mind to mind, you actually detect, you sense, you measure another person's consciousness. Scientists have been yearning for that for a long time, and I think they're still striving to develop something called a psychometer, a meter that would actually measure consciousness itself or the presence of mental events themselves and not simply their neurocorrelates or behavioral expressions. This is said to be, this is quite an extraordinary claim, that it's actually possible with refined attention, very, very refined attention, to actually be able to perceive consciousness itself. Another person's consciousness, not just your own. So if we had not only a biologist watching the egg get inseminated, but if there were a clairvoyant yogi, the clairvoyant yogi would, you do what you do well, you're observing the physical manifestation, I'll do what I do well. I'm going to observe the stream of the substrate consciousness coming in and then conjoining with that egg and sperm that you're observing from your perspective. And now we have a 3D, now we have a 3D perspective, right? And so Stephen Hawking, I see we have 3 minutes before 6:05, which is our new ending time. Stephen Hawking turned this global. That is, he turned this cosmic. By taking the principles of quantum mechanics and applying them into the whole cosmos, he's not the first one to do it. There are a number of very brilliant physicists. He's one among them who believe this is the way to go. And he directed his attention to time and specifically to history. If it's true that 13.7 billion years ago, there was a big bang and what came out of that was just an expanding space-time with configurations of mass energy in it, and that's all there was. And then over the 13.7 billion year evolution of the universe, then about 5 billion years ago, our planet formed. Somewhere between 3.5 and 4.5 billion years ago, the first single-celled organisms formed on this planet. And they mutated, evolved, became more complex, and eventually they turned into human organisms. If that's the story we're going to believe is absolutely true, then once again, everything I've said is false. Because everything does indeed boil down to configurations of mass energy within space-time. And that's absolutely primary, mass energy, which is exactly what the physicalists would have us believe. But Stephen Hawking, a physicist par excellence, said, that picture, that story, is based on the type of questions you were posing, and all of the questions you were posing were physical questions, based upon physical measurements. So what did you expect to come up with, other than matter is primary, since you can't measure anything else, not objectively, physically, and quantifiably? So that's a story. But that story was not already there, pre-existent, absolute, objective. That story arises relative to your systems of measurement and the kinds of questions you ask. Not only the present and the future, but the past, according to quantum cosmology, exists in a superposition state. The past exists as a state of possibility, of potentiality, of probabilities. And it becomes actualization depending on the type of question you pose and measurement you make, and the way you then interpret that measurement, the way you interpret, label, name the appearances. We, in the last 400 years, with the domination of science, have asked physical questions about the evolution of the universe. And lo and behold, we get a story that's based in physics, is garnered with biology, and finally the icing of mind sciences. Lo and behold, the evolution of the universe, as we presently conceive of it, follows exactly the same trajectory as the trajectory of modern science over the last 400 years. The first great revolution was in physics. Galileo, Newton. It was not biology, and it certainly wasn't the mind sciences. The second great revolution, the second great forge ahead, development ahead, was clearly biology, 1859, evolution of species. Right? The origin of species, sorry, Darwin. The next great movement in the natural sciences was biology. I think that can't be contested. And then, late 19th century, slowly, the slowpoke on the line, the Johnny-come-lately, was scientists studying the mind. Lo and behold, in our vision, the story we tell ourselves about the evolution of the universe, first came physics, then came biology, and then came consciousness. A macrocosmic projection of the last 400 years of the history of science. Was it necessary that the first great breakthrough in science had to be physics and not biology or the mind sciences? I don't see why. It could have been biology. And there were those who were promoting that, or an organic view of the universe. Biology could have been first. Physics could have been second. It could have been somebody brilliant like William James that started the whole scientific revolution and focused first upon radical empiricism. That would have been a very different story. The Buddhists have a very different story, because we've asked different questions and used different modes of observation. Final point, and I'm going to break. It's now 6:06. The Kala Chakra system is considered to be among the most sophisticated and comprehensive within Tibetan Buddhism. And the Kala Chakra system deals with everything: embryology, cosmology, cosmogony, path to liberation, enlightenment. It covers everything in a very synthetic, comprehensive fashion. I don't mean that presents everything that exists, but it is a very, very synthetic worldview together with a mode of practice leading to liberation and enlightenment. The Kala Chakra Tantra itself, which is considered to be, you know, highest level within Tibetan Buddhism, states there is no one absolutely true story about the universe. Not in terms of evolution or its layout, its constitution. We have stories of Mount Meru and the four continents. I see you. We have stories of the evolution from space particles arising out of empty space. We have stories. These stories are based upon experience, upon appearances. But none of our stories, and there are multiple stories within Buddhism, let alone the story of modern science, none of the stories are absolutely true. All of the stories are true, perhaps, relative to questions being posed, type of measurements being made. They exist relative to a cognitive frame of reference. So as with the computer, as with the brain, as with the universe, John Wheeler says the whole universe is an information processing system in which all sentient beings are observer participants co-forming the universe that they are experiencing. So that's a short answer. And we're finished for now. We have a bunch of other questions. But that's it. That's my best take. all those who couldn't stand anything I said are listening by way of podcast, and they can't go boo, boo. So you see, on people listening to my podcast, I have a very supportive audience here, sympathetic. That doesn't mean everybody should believe anything I said, but these are hypotheses. These can be put to the test of experience, and that's what makes it interesting. If it's philosophy ending in philosophy, I'm really not so interested. But these can be put to the test of experience. That means it's science and not just metaphysics. So, let's do it. Let's get our observatory going. Get the ball rolling.